We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show, and I'm glad to have here in studio once again David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign. Once a month on a Friday, he's here, and we talk about money management, and usually he begins by making a few comments, and then people have questions on their personal financial planning. Call in, and they can get some advice from Dave. Well, once again, glad to have you here. Welcome back.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I think I'd like to spend just a few minutes discussing the raging federal budget debate, and more importantly, what it may mean for you as an investor. Now, let's quickly review some sobering statistics. These were mined from U.S. Census data and the Congressional Budget Office. And I'm going to go back to last fiscal year 2010, where total federal spending approximated $3.5 trillion. Now, that's a tough number to get our hands on, so let's divide that number by about 311 million American citizens, and that's about $11,254 for every man, woman, and child. In other words, the federal outlay was a little over $11,000 for each of us. Well, the next question, of course, is what in the world did the government collect? And the government collected, that's us, of course, we collected $2.1 trillion in tax revenues. That's about $6,700 per person. So I guess the difference has to be what we would call a negative cash flow, which was $1.4 trillion. We essentially spent $1.4 trillion more than we took in fiscal year 2010. So here's the bottom line. If everyone would get out their checkbook in the U.S. of A., every man, woman, and child, and write a check back to the Department of the Treasury for $4,500, that would close the 2010 federal deficit. Now, that's in addition, of course, to the income taxes you've already paid, the state income taxes you've already paid, the Social Security and Medicare taxes that you've already paid. So that family of four needs to get out the checkbook and write a check for $18,000 back. So we sort of get an idea of the enormity of the size of these particular deficits. Now, total spending by the federal government can really be broken down into three major categories. We have something called mandatory spending. That's category number one. And that really comprises approximately 55% of all the money that is spent. We have a second category called discretionary spending, and that's about close to 40% of all the dollars we spend in the federal budget. And finally, we have something called category three, which are interest payments on our national debt, and that's approaching about 6%. Or 6 cents of every dollar we spend. Now, what are these mandatory spending items that really involve most of the money we spend in the federal budget? Well, it's led by Social Security. 20 cents of every dollar we spend is Social Security. In round numbers, it's $700 billion. Medicare, about 15%, 15 cents. Of every dollar we spend is Medicare, in round numbers, about $520 billion. Add other health expenditures like Medicaid, which covers less fortunate Americans, that's another 8 to 9%. Then we have something called income security. Most people aren't familiar with this. It's a big number. It's about 12 cents, or 12% of every dollar we spend. That's welfare, tax subsidies, unemployment benefits, and similar kinds of programs. Now, you add all of that up, you add all of that money up, and that comes to a sobering 55% of every dollar we spend, or close to $2 trillion. Now, we only take in 2.1, and this mandatory spending is approaching $2 trillion. And we haven't even gotten to the other categories yet, and the main one, of course, being discretionary spending. And this is where the $38 billion big compromise between the Democrats and the Republicans took place. It said we saved all this money. It came from the discretionary spending categories. Now, by far and away, the largest discretionary item is defense. And that item is about $700 billion, or about 20%. Interestingly enough, it's just about the same as Social Security. So whatever we spend in Social Security, that's about what we are spending in defense. Then there's everything else. And really, you can think of the cabinet positions, for example, transportation, education, health, veterans, administration of justice, international affairs, science, space, technology, general government, all of these other areas. And that represents about 17% of all the money we spend. In round numbers, it's about $600 billion. So here's the bottom line. We take in terms of federal revenues, just about enough to cover all of our mandatory spending. And then everything that's left over, discretionary spending, we're into a negative cash flow position. That's a tough place for Congress to find itself. It's a tough place for the president to find himself. Now, here are some additional statistics, and I hate to bore you with statistics, but they're important. Let's talk about GDP, our gross domestic product, which is really the sum of all goods and services that we create in the good old U.S. of A. In round numbers, it approximates $15 trillion. Let's talk about our national debt. Our national debt in round numbers approximates $14 trillion, and of course, it's growing by trillions of dollars each year. So in other words, our national debt is about 100% of our GDP. And here's the important point. If interest rates move up just 1% in our economy, all those treasury notes and treasury bonds and treasury bills, those governmental IOUs, if they just move up 1%, that means that we would have to pay our creditors another $150 billion annually, which then crowds out money for public broadcasting. It crowds out money for education. It crowds out money for all kinds of important programs in the United States. So to get a handle on this tremendous deficit problem, there has to be an old-fashioned reality check. People need to understand these numbers. And they need to understand that middle-class entitlement programs now comprise over 44% of every dollar spent. That's just Social Security and basically Medicare. And we need to understand that at the same time, there's going to be some changes to those entitlement programs. They're not going to get more expensive. They can't. There are going to have to be some cuts. And at the same time, I think it's a foregone conclusion, and people are going to come yelling and screaming, but somehow income taxes are going to go up. They've got to be increased. There has to be pain across both corridors here. And most likely, it seems to me, on the income tax side, rather than rates being raised, I think what you're going to see are corporate loopholes being removed, as well as tax deductions for individuals being removed. Things like interest deductions on your personal residence. Those are the kinds of things that I think are going to eventually be removed. And in other words, that will result in more net tax revenues. Okay, that's sort of the backdrop economically, but what does that mean for you and I as an investor, from an investor standpoint? I think the Federal Reserve is going to do everything in its power to keep interest rates at rock bottom for the immediate future because we can't afford higher interest payments. So here are my predictions, and I usually don't go out on the line and make predictions, but I'm going to make these predictions. One, don't expect higher CD rates in the next 6 to 12 months. In spite of inflationary pressures at the gas pump, in spite of much higher prices at the grocery store, I don't think we're going to see higher interest rates in the short run. Two, expect the value of our dollar to continue to lose purchasing power, making everything we buy more expensive. I don't think there's any question about that. Three, good news for farmers. I think farmland will continue to increase in value faster than inflation, reflecting higher commodity prices and agricultural demand, especially expanding in the emerging markets. Four, I think a diversified stock portfolio will outperform a bond portfolio over the next 12 months. Five, if you have cash and are waiting for higher interest rates, you've got to stay patient. That is the bottom line. You still need to have a cash position. It's important to have liquidity, but it's going to be a while before you are going to, as an investor, see higher interest rates. One, because the Federal Reserve has no interest in increasing interest rates. It just makes the national debt more bloody expensive. And two, we are still rebuilding the balance sheets of banks. So banks can pay us basically nothing on our money, and they can turn around and invest it basically risk-free in treasuries. And finally, six, I think mortgage rates are going to continue to be very attractive for the next 6 to 12 months. So if you are in the market to purchase a new home or a previously owned home, I think you are going to continue to see very attractive mortgage rates, not too far from their historic lows. So I think we'll stay tuned as Congress and the President wrestle with this budget. It is an enormous, enormous problem. Next, each month we review our couch potato portfolio, consisting of 8 index mutual funds available through the Vanguard family of mutual funds. I want to point out that most of these index funds are available also through other mutual fund providers as well. And recall that these 8 funds consist of indexes of very large companies, very small companies, international companies, U.S. companies, REITs, real estate investment trusts. Of course, you can go to the WILL website, look for the Couch Potato portfolio, and it has been updated through yesterday's close. And indeed, through yesterday's close, the portfolio year-to-date, I'm pleased to report, is a positive 5.5% compared to our benchmark S&P, which is also positive, and that's up about 5%. So the truth of the matter is that the portfolios are pretty much running neck-to-neck at the moment. Maybe diversification is ahead 0.5%, but that would be an unfair conclusion really to reach. Basically, our portfolio and the S&P are running about neck to neck. So there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to answer questions on our listeners' minds. And of course, I'd also like to say that it is a personal privilege for me to have been part of this show for really more than 2 decades. And I truly hope that the listeners will answer the call, and because it is really fun for me to not only do this show, but to listen to the literally scores and scores of wonderful programming that WILL has provided not only to me, but to all listeners. And especially, I enjoy listening to you and Celeste. It's really a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. We got a caller here who's been patient with us. We'll get to them. Dave Sinnoh, by the way, is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. And for, as you said, for a long time, we've been doing this show every Friday. So people will have this regular opportunity to ask questions about money management. So 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign County on line 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Well, David, I'm happy to announce that I've answered the call twice this pledge period.
Thank you so much.
Since today is generally when taxes are due, my question is related to taxes. I'd like to know what your recommendation is for a retired couple in their mid-70s in the 25% tax bracket who regularly save and invest in Vanguard's tax-efficient index funds.
Yes.
But the more that is saved generates more dividends, which are taxed probably at increasing rates. So what we're considering is putting future savings in a tax-deferred account, specifically in our Vanguard variable annuity with expense ratio of about a 0.5%, to avoid paying more taxes on the dividends from the taxable accounts. And I need to add, we don't anticipate withdrawing those funds from that annuity unless one or both of us require long-term care. So I just wonder if you'd concur in investing future savings in a tax-deferred annuity versus taxable mutual funds to avoid paying taxes, which result in additional dividends and taxes. So.
Well, the real question you're asking is, does it make more sense to pay at a 25% federal income tax rate or hedge your bets, defer current taxes, and someone, either yourselves or someone else, paying at the tax rate in the future? Now, with a variable annuity, this is important to understand. A variable annuity, it's all right to have it in your name, and if the beneficiary is your surviving spouse, then at that point in time, there is no federal income tax due on that money. However, if the ultimate beneficiary is a child, for example, someone other than a spouse or a charity, then when that money essentially devolves, gets passed, is conveyed, if you will, to the contingent, the secondary beneficiary, then the taxes are going to be due. And you might run into not only an income tax issue, but it is also going to be in someone's estate for estate tax purposes. So you might get hammered twice. So I'm a little bit concerned about that. Now, if you believed that the ultimate beneficiary of this money is going to be in a lower tax bracket, or in the alternative, for example, was going to be a charity, for example, WILL, all right, then that problem goes away. So I'm not convinced that that strategy is really, in the long run, going to be a tax-saving strategy. In the short run, it is a tax-saving strategy because you're obviously deferring the tax. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. The other thing I want to point out is if you go ahead and pay the tax today in a tax-efficient mutual fund, when you eventually sell those shares, presumably you would sell them at a higher price, you are going to generate capital gains as opposed to ordinary income. And historically, the capital gains tax rate has been a lower rate, at least at the federal level, than the ordinary income tax rate. So I'm not certain that you really are going to accomplish what you want to in the long run. In the short run, you will.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, food for thought.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much. Other questions are certainly welcome, and I have a couple of emails here we'll get to. David Sinnoh is here with us. He's on the program every month to take questions on money management. And a very long time ago, we decided that there were a few things that we wanted to build into the program as regular features because we knew people would always have questions on these things. That's why it is we have some health topics we do either monthly or every other month, and why it is that Dave is here every month, and there are other sorts of things that we have built into the schedule so people can say, all right, on this particular day, I know there'll be somebody there on the program that can answer my question. And in addition, we do these in addition to all the other kinds of topics that we do on the show. We have tried to make it as useful as it can be so that people can come to the show, they can dial the number, they can say, okay, here's my question, what do you think? That's what we've been doing here now for 30 years with this program. And I've been fortunate to be able to host it, and people have told me over time they think it's a pretty good show. And I appreciate that. But there's something else you could do in addition to saying that you think it's a pretty good show, and that is to help pay for it. Not only the show, but everything else that you value on this station. That's what we're all about here this week, encouraging people to be financial supporters of the station. It's not complicated. You give us a call, go online, you go to 244-9455, go to willpledge.org, and you make a contribution. Some people have said, I think that's probably worth $1 a week. So they gave us $52. You want to do more? That's great. But we'd really like to hear from you. You can help us meet our fundraising goals. In the studio with me this morning is Mark Leonard. He's our general manager.
Well, thank you, David. And David, what a great example of what public radio and WILL are able to do. David, just gave an incredibly concise and understandable answer to an incredibly complicated topic, at least for the layman. And the ability to decode complex ideas is kind of a hallmark of public radio and WILL. And we are proud to be able to offer this program monthly and Focus daily, bringing you information and access that you would not get anywhere else to ideas and to people. It's a unique service. Public radio is a unique service, and the way we pay for it is unique because we don't have advertisers. So we're asking for you in this Friday edition of Focus to help pay the bills by calling 244-9455 and pledge some level of support to the station. The amount is less important than the act of making the call and participating. So whatever fits your budget, whatever fits the amount of enjoyment and the value of the resource in your life, put a price on it, price tag on it, and either go online to willpledge.org or to call the number 244-9455 and say, yeah, I want to join the 13,000 people that make this possible every single weekday of the year.
Well, thank you very much. We have some callers here on the line. I got some emails. We're already at the midpoint, so I'm going to try to do my best to get everybody in here. 333-9455 is for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. That's the toll-free line. And email will-talk at illinois.edu. Let's go to the phones for somebody up in Niles in the Chicago area. Line 4. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. And good morning, Dr. Sino.
Good morning.
My question is actually two parts. I wanted to see if I could get a handle on either income-wise as well as tax-wise what the differences might be between a life annuity and a gift annuity. And my part B of that same question concerns annuities also. And I was wondering what your thoughts are about annuities, which would generate some sort of stream of income as opposed to dividend-paying stocks, let's say.
Those are terrific questions. Let's understand what an annuity is. First of all, an annuity is a periodic stream of payments. And generally, there are two parties involved, the annuitant, that's the person who has the money, and the insurance company. That's the institution that you hand the money to. So there are a number of different kinds of annuities that you mentioned. One is called a life annuity, or sometimes it's referred to as an immediate annuity. And that is where you would take a specific sum of money, generally after-tax money, and you would then convey it to the insurance company. And in consideration of that conveyance to the insurance company would immediately, within a month, start paying you a periodic payment for the rest of your life. Now, if it is called a life annuity, it is based solely on your life. Often these annuities are based upon two lives called joint and survivor annuities.
Yes.
Well, let's take the example where you hand $10,000 to an insurance company and they say to you, we're going to pay you $100 for the rest of your life. What would happen if 1 year later, after you received $1,200 of payments, suddenly you passed away and you had given the insurance company $10,000? Well, typically what occurs is that there is a provision in these contracts that call for a refund. And that refund is typically, in other words, just about what you put in if you haven't at least pulled that amount out. So that takes care of that problem. So there are often good reasons to purchase what is called an immediate life annuity or an immediate joint and survivor annuity, because as long as the annuitant is alive, they continue to receive a stream of payments. So you can't outlive that particular money. Now, that's in contradistinction to something called a gift annuity. That involves yourself and some type of charitable organization. So, for example, you could take that $10,000 and you could gift it to the U of I Foundation for the benefit of WILL. And in that gift annuity, you would then be paid each month, each quarter, each year, a certain payment, which is based upon your actuarial life expectancy and national gift annuity table rates. And when you make that gift to a charity, interestingly enough, a portion of that gift is immediately an itemized tax deduction. And each month when you receive money back, a portion of the money that you're actually receiving back is some of your own principal that you originally gave the charity, as well as some interest. And that portion that is a return of principal is not taxed, but the portion that is income or interest is taxed. So that is a wonderful way of making charitable gifts and still getting a stream of payments while you are living. And many, many people make gift annuities to charitable organizations based upon a husband and a wife on joint lives. And it's a wonderful giving opportunity, and at the same time, you are still receiving a periodic payment. And indeed, that periodic payment that you're receiving is often larger than putting that money in a dividend-paying stock, than putting that money in a certificate of deposit at a local financial institution. So that's a little bit about immediate annuities, gift annuities. Now, the previous caller talked about something called a variable annuity. And that is where you simply take a sum of money, you convey it to an insurance company, and then the insurance company says, look, we're going to put the investment responsibility on your shoulders. We're going to provide you with the opportunity to choose how you want that money invested in different mutual funds, perhaps even in certain stocks. And then, depending upon how that annuity does, well, it's no longer our responsibility. It's yours as an investor. And then at some point in time, you start accessing that money. And the first money that comes out is the gain, the deferred gain that you have earned on that annuity. And that's taxed at ordinary income tax rates. So before you decide on a gift annuity, an immediate annuity, a variable annuity, it's very important, one, to understand exactly what they are, and two, probably talking with your financial advisor to see what is really appropriate for you.
And I would imagine from our discussion that the gift annuity, whether joint survivor or single, may have some very important advantages. Over
it does.
Especially even consider the third alternative, which would be dividend-paying stock.
Exactly. It really does, especially for people who are charitably minded and want to benefit a charity. And typically the kind of asset that is used, other than cash, to fund a gift annuity is appreciated stock or appreciated mutual funds. So, for example, if you long time ago had bought some Google stock for maybe $10,000 and today it's worth $100,000 and you say, gee, if I sell the stock, I have to pay a capital gains tax on the gain. And in that particular example, that would be $90,000 of gain, and I would have to pay 15% of that to the federal government and 5% to the state of Illinois. So I essentially would be giving away almost $18,000, and then whatever I had left, I could do whatever I want with. Alternatively, you could gift that appreciated security directly to the charity, and you pay no capital gains tax. It disappears. So now the entire $100,000 goes to the charity, and they then turn around and pay you an annuitized gift annuity payment on that entire $100,000. It's a win-win situation.
Wonderful. Okay, well, thank you for that. It's very clear, the explanation. And I, like the rest of the people who listen in, I'm sure are grateful for the information.
All right, well, thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
This is Focus, and I'm David Inge, and David Sinnoh is here with me. He is on the program once a month, always on a Friday. He's a clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. We talk about money management. Real quick here before I go to another caller, I got an email here from somebody who must have heard the passing mention of it being April 15th, and that's tax day. However, I would like to say this, and I do believe this is true. The caller here, the listener, says, I hope Mr. Sinnoh can verify that this year, Monday,
correct,
the 18th, is the deadline.
Correct.
It's not today. So
correct.
You actually do have a couple more
So
days.
Here's my theory and my notion. Don't party this weekend, all right? Don't enjoy the environment this weekend. Sit home, all right? and figure out exactly what you owe, send it in, and then, oh, by the way, if you feel especially, well, you have that feeling of largesse, that $4,500 negative cash flow per person that I pointed out in my introductory remarks, just send another $4,500 in, or better yet, send it to WILL.
Yeah, better yet, send it to WILL. All right, out to San Francisco, online too here. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Ainge, Mr. Suno.
What are you doing out in San Francisco now? Oh, I know you have family out there, right?
Yes, I have quite a bit of family out here.
All right.
And I know Mr. Sunu is from this area, too. The weather is a little chilly right now. But the question I have, Mr. Sunu, you didn't mention unemployment. If we had a higher level of employment, we'd get a lot more taxes back and help our situation.
Well, there's no question about that. As a matter of fact, when we look at the entire workforce, and I'm not sure if I wrote those numbers down or not, our entire workforce, and people disagree about what this number is, but it's somewhere between 140 and 150 million people at full employment would actually be drawing a paycheck. And right now, we know that there are just a very substantial number of people who are either unemployed or underemployed. And it probably, if we add those two together, depending upon who you believe, it's at least a 15% number. And if we took 15% times the workforce, that's well over 20 million people. So you are absolutely right that if we had more people employed, we would be certainly receiving more tax revenues. Fewer people would retire at 62 and start accessing Social Security, which puts Social Security in a negative cash flow situation. Of course, we have a number of structural problems, and that is that even among the Fortune 1000 companies, almost 6 out of every 10 jobs now that the Fortune 1000 companies are creating are jobs abroad. That's a problem. We don't have to look any further than Peoria, Illinois, and Caterpillar, which has been in the news for weeks. And if we actually look at the number of jobs that have been lost in central Illinois by a great giant of a company and where those jobs are moving to, they're moving globally. They're moving abroad. And small businesses, on the other hand, create 9 out of every 10 jobs, and most of those jobs are domestic jobs. Those are jobs created in the U.S. of A. But because our banks are in such tough shape and are unwilling really to lend to small business, they are still rebuilding their balance sheets. Small businesses don't have the capital to expand, and hence they are not hiring people. It's part of this structural dilemma. And so you are absolutely right. If we could wave a magic wand and get more of these folks employed in meaningful positions, it would really help.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Well, I have an email here from somebody that concerns the proposed changes in the CSRS money purchase calculation. And this is apparently the formula that they use to calculate the monthly annuity benefits for retirees. And it is a change that has proposed that would go into effect next year. And apparently it's been estimated that as a result of this change, that then the monthly annuity benefit that people receive will actually go down.
That's true.
Reduced.
That's
now,
true.
What the person says is here now, how can, says, can you explain why that change does not violate the reduce or diminishment clause in the state constitution? Because apparently it says something like that benefits will never be
diminished and or impaired.
Okay.
That's what it says.
So that seems like a diminishment to me.
Well, it sounds like on its face it certainly is a diminishment. However, there was a wonderful seminar/program put on at the University of Illinois last week by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Mm-hmm. I think Professor Rich orchestrated that. He's been a guest on your program many, many times. And there was a very prominent woman from the University of Illinois Law School. And I apologize, I don't have her name right off the top of my fingertips here. But she was extraordinarily knowledgeable about this very issue. And when I sat there and listened to her, I came to the conclusion that this is going to be an issue that is going to be decided by the Supreme Court of the state of Illinois. whether or not this, under the context of what seems to be very clear language, that we can change these rules, and I think it's going to be up to the Supreme Court. And if you look at historic changes of things that look very, very clear on their face, sometimes things get changed because of financial exigencies. So we have to look at not only the question of clarity of the language, but what impact the finances have. So I'm not willing to sit here and tell you how that's going to come out, but I do believe that these kinds of issues, actually changes in SERS or any of the pension programs, which on their face would seem to diminish benefits, that is going to end up with the Illinois Supreme Court.
All right. Well, it sounds like something that we should talk about on the show. So perhaps we can put together a program sometime soon and talk about this, because I'm sure in the interest of full disclosure, I'm in the system.
I'm in the system.
Lots of people who are listening to us are and have those sorts of questions. So perhaps that's something we can come back to. Let me do something else here. And this near the end of last month's program, we got an email, and I'm sorry that we didn't get it in. And I want to ask the question now, and I can only hope that the person who wrote in is listening. The person says, could you please explain how to handle tax-deferred annuities when you reach 70 and a half and have to take minimum required distribution? And the caller, the listener specifically, was wondering about, can you do this over the phone? If you don't want to spend the distribution, can you invest it? And what would you suggest maybe they do with that money?
Okay, that's a great question. And many, many people who are federal employees, state employees, charitable employees, they generally have the opportunity to establish tax-deferred annuity programs. They're often referred to as 403B programs. They're not unlike an IRA or a 401K, and that is that they put money aside, and then when they reach 70 and a half, since this money has generally been taken out of their paycheck, it has never been taxed, well, the tax man cometh. You know the old story, the tax man cometh and taketh away. And the tax man says that when you reach 70 and a half, the actual rule says the April 1 following the year in which you reach 70 and a half, but most people take it when they're 70 and a half, you have to start taking annual distributions out of your tax-deferred annuity. Now, as it turns out, if you look at the actual table, the first year distribution is about 1/27th of the previous year-end balance. So, for example, let's say that there was a balance on December 31 of 2010 of $100,000. Now, it's 2011, and you are now 70 and a half, and you say, oh my, I now need to take some money out of this tax-deferred annuity. I'd have to take 1/27th, which is about 3.5%, or say $3,500 of money. That money has to come out. You can do anything you want with it. You can give it to David Sinnoh. You can give it to WILL. You can reinvest it in mutual funds, dividends, whatever you want to do with it. But the bottom line is that $3,500 is going to be taxable income. You're going to have to report it on your 2011 tax return, which is essentially due April 15th of 2012. Can you do this over the telephone? In many cases, you can. You can call up wherever you have the money. It's often in a mutual fund, and you can make arrangements to have that taken out over the phone. Often you can download a form on the computer, send it in. There are a variety of ways to do this. It's not very painful, other than the realization that you must take the money out and you must pay income taxes on it. Now you have after-tax money, and you can do anything you want with that money.
All right. Here's the question. We've gotten this question before, and I think we can deal with it pretty quick, I hope, and then we're going to take one more caller. Someone who wants to know specifically, she says the Couch Potato Index does not list the specific fund names, and whether you can talk about the specific funds that go into this.
Okay. Very, very quickly, even though I don't list the symbols, you really can tell very quickly. The S&P 500 is called the Index 500. So that's number one. U.S. large value is called the Value Index. U.S. small cap is called the U.S. Small Cap Index. Small cap value is small cap value index. It's actually listed in Vanguard this way. The mid cap is the U.S. mid cap index. There is only one REIT fund by Vanguard, so that's REIT. There is an index called the Total International Index, only one of those. And there is only one emerging markets mutual fund that they have. That's the Emerging Markets Fund. So really, by looking at them, the only confusing one is something I call U.S. large value. And if you look for large value index, you'll find it.
Okay. The caller was interested in transferring money that she has in IRA to something like Vanguard. Apparently, she's not happy with paying brokerage fees. She says she's only receiving about 2% on her a year on her IRA accounts. Should I dollar cost average? And I'm sure you'd say yes. And would the couch potato index be a good vehicle? Or she's wondering, is there enough diversification in here?
Well, for your stock position, there is certainly enough diversification. And if you are currently in stocks, then you could simply move into these stock mutual funds without dollar cost averaging. Oh, however, okay. If you have a lot of your money in cash, I'm not going to suggest that you immediately just throw all that cash into this portfolio, because it would be our luck that the day you did it, it would drop precipitously. So then you would dollar cost average in perhaps over 12 to 18 months.
All right. One more caller here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious. This change that was mentioned a bit ago about in the SERS monthly payout formula.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a legislative change, or who dictated that? The SERS board, or what?
First of all, this would have to be, I believe, you know, I'm not absolutely certain, so I hesitate to answer that question. Basically, that's a question that is better reserved for your SERS annuitant association. Are you currently retired? Well, if you are currently retired, it does not impact you.
Oh, I see. It's only the future retirees.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
So I can clear that part of it up. But for further analysis on it, you really need to talk to your SERS Annuitant Association.
All right, thank you. I believe, now what the person who wrote in the email also forwarded, looks like a news release on this, and it makes it look as if this was something that was done by the SERS board.
I believe it was, and I believe it doesn't go into effect until next year.
That's right. That's also the other thing. If it happens, it will go into effect no sooner than January of 2012.
Exactly.
Is what it says.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Let me see here. Maybe we can, in fact, go. Let's go to Edgewood, line four. Hello.
Yes, David. I don't want to beat a dead horse here with the retirement of state municipal employees, but this early retirement, I just had a friend retired at age 52. My father retired at age 52. I'm 52. When they retire employees early from cities and counties and states, explain to me how that actually saves money, and also school districts, because I don't think it does.
Well, I'm not sure it does either, for a couple of reasons. Obviously, it saves money in the short run if you replace that employee with a less expensive employee. But when you think about it overall, it's then costing the state more money or the pension system more money to pay out that annuitant. And I think equally as important is the intellectual capital that is lost. When you retire early, think of all the intellectual capital, all the know-how, all the knowledge that you have, and we're replacing you with a new person who doesn't have any of that history, any of that intellectual capital. So it's a steep learning curve. So I have never been convinced, other than in the very short run, it may save a bit of money for states or municipalities by shifting the burden to these pension funds. But unfortunately, because of the funding of these pension funds, the woeful lack of funding, in the long run, it's not a great strategy.
We're going to have to stop there. I appreciate all the calls and the emails. I hope we've answered some questions. Dave will be back next month. This is something we do every month on the show with David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. We've been doing it every month for a very long time as a regular feature, so that people will know that they will have this opportunity to ask questions and that will be there every month. So I want to say to you, Dave, again, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you. It's always fun.